My subject tonight, the ultimate urgency of the second coming. How near is near? How soon is soon? And what is the secret of finally, really making it? Come with me to a little town called Loehampton, New York. Today they have dropped the low. Maybe they didn't think it cast a very good impression on the public. Call it Hampton, New York today, but it was Loehampton on October 22, 1844. The most famous resident in town had come home, brought a friend with him, Joshua V. Hines, his public relations and publications specialist. William Miller, 62 years old, worn out, totally worn out, practically blind, covered with boils like Job of old. 12 or 14 years he'd been out in the hustings preaching his heart out, and now today is the day, October 22, 1844, and he brought Hines with him, and they sat on the front porch, and all day long little clusters of Millerites would come along and shake their hands and encourage one another. As the sun made its way from the eastern heavens across the sky to the western skies, as the sun began to sink into the west, there was a bit of nervousness and apprehension. People were beginning to get a little uneasy. He hadn't come yet. When the sun finally went down, they gathered in different homes of those of like faith to encourage one another. They had a little song service, they had a little testimony meeting, they had a prayer season, and one of them would encourage another by saying, "Hey, you know, yeah, it's getting late, but remember, we didn't call this the midnight cry for nothing. Jesus is going to fulfill even that part of the symbolism, for the bridegroom came at midnight, and so he'll come." And they girded up their loins anew and continued singing and praising and praying, until the grandfather clocks struck midnight, and at 12:01 a.m., the day of the great disappointment began. Sometimes we make a mistake in Adventism, and we call October 22 the day of great disappointment. It couldn't have been farther from the fact. October 22 was the day he was coming. It was a day of great anticipation. But he did not come. Then October 23, began the day of great disappointment. The Millerite movement, he himself, as Dr. Burrell pointed out in one of his earlier morning presentations, I hope you've been blessed by them as I have. Dr. Burrell pointed out that the figures for the movement membership vary. Miller himself claimed about 50,000, but historians have upped it to 200,000 and even more. I've even seen 250,000. On October 23, the Millerite movement fell apart. It broke into roughly four divisions, not equal divisions. The largest of the four groups were those who, in acute personal and social embarrassment, left all religion of all kind. They felt they had been duped. They felt they had been tricked. Jesus played a dirty trick on them. And they were angry, they were embarrassed, the conflicting emotions would be hard to describe if you hadn't gone through that. And they left all religion. There was a second group who went into various forms of fanaticism and even time setting, but they pretty much played themselves out by 1852, 53, 54, and every time they set a date, he never showed up, and finally people get weary of that kind of game. The third group were those who continued to look for the coming, and Dr. Burrell told us a little bit about them, the Advent Christian Church. I had the privilege of meeting with that congregation in a suburb of Boston some years ago. I was teaching at Pacific Union College, and they gave me a week to do a little Advent history, historical research in New England. I took the red-eye special out of San Francisco International Airport on Saturday night and arrived at Boston's Logan Airport early Sunday morning. And I freshened myself up in the restroom of the airport and took a taxi out and I worshiped with the Advent Christian Church in one of those suburbs of Boston. When they found out who I was, they gave me an extraordinarily warm welcome. And when the pastor stood up to speak in his introductory remarks, he said, "We have one of our brothers from the Seventh-day Adventist Church. We have the same roots as the Seventh-day Adventists. These are First-day Adventists." And he gave me a tremendous welcome. And after the service was over, so many came up and spoke very warmly about how we shared common roots together. But as Dr. Burrell also mentioned this week, they are a dying people. They had a college in Aurora, Illinois, and it today is a public two-year junior college. And anyone doing research on William Miller has to make their pilgrimage to Aurora College, because that's where Miller's memorabilia and manuscripts and all of his papers and everything are being housed. They had another school in New England in Lenox, Massachusetts, their only North American ministerial training school, Berkshire College, and it closed its doors not long ago. Their membership decline has been precipitous, and they are really a dying denomination, wonderful people. Ellen White had a twin sister, Elizabeth Harmon Bangs. She married a Mr. Bangs in Portland, Maine, spent her days there. Ellen White had a twin sister who never became a Sabbath keeper. And the Seventh-day Adventist Church has a twin sister, the Advent Christian Church, who never accepted the Sabbath or that very special prophetic gift. The fourth and final group to come out of Millerism, a handful, they would begin to emphasize the keeping of the seventh-day Sabbath. They claimed a prophetic gift within their midst. They began to develop an understanding of what Jesus is doing now, and they became Seventh-day Adventists, took their name in 1860, organized their general conference in 1863 with a half dozen state conferences already organized, and they were off and running. And today, somewhere between 9 and 10 million, I guess, every nation, kindred, tongue, and people. But sadly, our twin sister, the Advent Christian Church, did not continue to grow as we have continued to grow. And maybe a clue can be found in a resolution that appeared in one of their publications a few years ago. Let me just read you a few sentences to get the flavor of the feeling in that body. For many years, our people have been suggesting various answers to the anxious question, "What's wrong with us?" Others have impatiently come up with the criticism that the form of the question is wrong. We ought to ask, "What is right with us?" When shall we begin to achieve real honesty with ourselves? You can't solve problems merely by turning the form of the question around and ignoring the real issue. And the issue is that, in spite of organization, plans, projects, budgets, and whistling in the dark, there is something radically wrong that remains untouched by our optimism and our easy solutions. One brother says that the main trouble with us is that we don't love His appearing anymore. If we did, we would hang up our charts and tell the world that judgment is coming. A little thought should make it very evident to any of us that we can never again preach the kingdom message as our fathers preached it and make an impact upon the church or the world. We don't understand the time periods. We still believe we were basically right about the symbols of Daniel and Revelation, and yet the whole subject of predictive prophecy is so involved that it is utterly impossible for any Adventist preacher to go to the people with the same deep conviction and sense of certainty that our fathers did. And because we can't and don't, it seems to the church that we have lost our message and our reason of being, reason for being. You cannot rejuvenate the Advent Christian people unless and until a sense of certainty and urgency gives wings to our words and we can speak with confidence and certainty. People often ask, why don't we have any great prophetic preaching anymore in our midst? The simple fact is that such preaching is utterly impossible today. For prophetic preaching of the historicist school to carry any weight with intelligent audiences in our day, we shall have to know a lot of things that we don't know and can't. No, but to keep our self-respect and win the respect of the people, we must refrain from pretending to know what we do not know. To keep on saying that he's coming soon will impress no one, least of all the kind of audience that we have a great need of reaching. And with no message, they are going under. 154 years is a long time to wait for anything. And we've been waiting since 1844 for Jesus to come. How can we stand up in the pulpit with 154 years between us and the date he was expected and keep our self-respect and tell the people that he's coming soon? How soon is soon? How near is near? In 1944, 54 years ago, I went to La Sierra College, as it was then called, for the first time as a freshman. Remember very well that day when I walked into Calkins Hall, the men's residence hall, for the first time, and the monitor, Harold Moody, greeted me. And we have become friends, strong friends, ever since. The semester had hardly gotten underway when October 22 showed up on the calendar. And this was October 22, 1944. 100 years, the centennial of 1844. And I still remember that special chapel program that all of the students attended. I still have in my yearbook at home that special edition of the campus newspaper that came out commemorating October 22, 1844. And we wondered, when will Jesus come? Some of us wondered if time would last long enough to get married. And if it did, we had an idea about who we would like to make our spouse. Graduated 4 years later in June of 1948. 50 years ago, next June 8th, just a few days. And went into the ministry of the Southern California Conference and wondered about the second coming and how soon it would come. Yes, I got married, but would we have enough time to have children, to raise a family, to do things that other people had done before us? Well, we didn't know. We trusted the Lord. 1952 came. Ordination to the gospel ministry. And shortly after that, an invitation to go out to West Africa to be missionaries in Nigeria, to run the Voice of Prophecy work in West Africa, which we did for two of our four terms of service. And I still remember how the members of our church in Compton, California, went down to Union Station. People traveled on the trains in those days. Went down to Union Station, and right there on the platform, right next to the train, they formed a little circle around Irene and me, and they sang, "God be with you till we meet again." And they prayed and they cried, and we prayed and we cried. And we got on the train to head to New Orleans, changed the railroad station there, and got on another train, took us up through Spartanburg, on up to Washington, D.C., on up to New York and the Queen Mary. And as we said our goodbyes in Union Station in 1952, I really doubted that we would see our first furlough in 1955. We had a 30-month term of service and a 6-month furlough, making a 3-year cycle. Today they've cut that down to 21 months and 3 months, making a 2-year cycle. But we saw our first furlough in 1955. In fact, we spent a few days in Spartanburg with the Moody's. We went back for the second term. Would we see a second furlough? Yes. And a third? Yes. And at the end of a fourth term, we saw permanent return. Went to school for 3 years at Michigan State University, doing a little postgraduate study. Went on to Pacific Union College. Well, when is the Lord coming? Well, he's coming soon. His coming is near. 11 years. At Pacific Union College, and the invitation to return to pastoral work at the Tacoma Park Church at the General Conference headquarters across the street. 3 years there, then into the White Estate for the last 12 years of salaried service. Finally, the day came when I filled out some papers in the general conference. I never dreamed that this day would come, retirement. But here I was, one of the retired brethren. And here I was claiming what we used to call sustentation. They've dignified it. They call it the retirement benefit now. It's the same thing, and it comes every month, and we're glad it does. Social Security. I'm a Republican, but I sure appreciate Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Social Security Act. And between the two of them, they keep us living comfortably enough, and we're able to contribute still to the church. Not quite to the degree that we would like to or were able before. And now, I don't get a salary. Still working for the church. Maybe I'm getting paid what I'm worth now. And Jesus hasn't come yet. How can Roger Kuhn stand up and preach with assurance and certainty that his coming draweth nigh and hasteth greatly? Well, that problem was faced by Ellen White in 1851. In one of her earliest writings, Mrs. White said, "I saw that the time for Jesus to be in the most holy place was nearly finished." The date was 1851. "I saw that the time for Jesus to be in the most holy place was nearly finished, and that time can last but a little longer." 32 years later, in 1883, someone in the church of that day resurrected this statement and threw it in her face and called her a false prophet. Her reply is as instructive as it is interesting. This is what she said. As the subject was presented, and I'm reading from Selected Messages, Book 1, page 67. You can read it there too. "As the subject was presented before me, the period of Christ's ministration seemed almost accomplished. Am I accused of falsehood because time has continued longer than my testimony seemed to indicate? How is it with the testimonies of Christ and his disciples? Were they deceived?" And then she quotes a few well-selected texts, and she could have picked as many more again. First of all, she quotes Paul. Paul writes to the Corinthians, "But this I say, brethren, the time is short." And she italicized the words. "The time is short." And that was 1,800 years ago when she was defending herself. To the Romans, he said, "The night is far spent. The day is at hand. Let us therefore cast off the works of darkness and let us put on the armor of light." From Patmos, Christ speaks to us by the beloved John. "Blessed is he that readeth, and they that hear the words of this prophecy and keep those things which are written therein. For the time is at hand." 1,900 years ago, and Jesus said, "The time is at hand." And then she goes on to quote from Revelation 22. And she only quotes one of the three times Jesus said, "Behold, I come quickly. Behold, I come quickly. Surely I come quickly." And she only quotes one of the three. The Lord God of the holy prophets sent his angel to show unto his servants the things which must shortly be done. "Behold, I come quickly. Blessed is he that keepeth the sayings of the prophecy of this book." And then she went on defending herself from being a false prophet because she said that Jesus was coming soon and he hadn't come yet. The angels of God, in their messages to men, represent time as very short. "Thus it has always been presented to me. It is true that time has continued longer than we expected in the early days of this message. Our Savior did not appear as soon as we hoped, but has the word of the Lord failed? Never! Exclamation point. It should be remembered that the promises and threatenings of God alike are conditional. I'm very interested in noting here two things. First of all, Ellen White went to the Bible for her defense. That's an admirable example for us. We do well to follow that example today. Secondly, she spoke about the conditional element of some, not all, but some prophecy, and explains that we need to investigate that a little further. And this is often an overlooked element. There is in some prophecy a conditional element, which theologians are wont to call by the name conditionality. You see, some prophecies of true prophets are conditional. If a man responds in a certain way, what is predicted will surely come to pass. But if a man changes his attitudes and his responses, the predicted threatenings and warnings, yes, even the promises do not come to pass. And of course, the classic example is Jonah. When Jonah trudged the road, dusty road to Nineveh, Jonah had already entered a prophetic ministry. He had already made one prediction about the boundary, northern boundary of Judah, Israel. And Jonah had a batting average in baseball standards of 1,000. One prediction, one fulfillment. Now in baseball, even a 500 batting average isn't bad. But if you are of the idea that a true prophet must be right every time he makes a prediction, and if he isn't, that he automatically, ipso facto, is a false prophet. And there are people in our church today who believe that. There are people in other churches that believe that. A true prophet's predictions must always come to pass 100% of the time, or evidence he isn't a true prophet. And so Jonah was reluctant to go. He had a hunch the Lord was going to double cross him up there in Nineveh. And he didn't want to go. Anyway, he hated the Ninevites with a purple passion. And if you were a loyal Jew, you would too, because the Assyrians were among the most ferocious and warlike peoples. We use the expression to skin someone alive. The technical term is flay, F-L-A-Y. The Assyrians invented that and developed it to a very fine art. When they captured a prisoner of war, they would peel the skin off to extract the utmost amount of trauma. And then after they had done their torture, then they would take the life of the prisoner. They took no prisoners of war. And the Jews feared the Ninevites and they hated them. And I can imagine that as Jonah was going up preaching up and down the streets 40 days and 40 nights, and the Lord's going to give you what you deserve, and I'm going to sit on a little hillside outside of town and watch every one of you bite the dust, and as everyone goes down, I'm going to applaud. Well, now, maybe he didn't quite say all of that, but he sure felt it in his heart. You got to understand Jonah. But when he'd finished his preaching and he went outside of town to watch and smack his lips as the Ninevites one by one bit the dust, it didn't happen. And the book of Jonah closes with Jonah flinging his puny fist in the face of the Almighty and saying, I knew you'd double-cross me, Lord. And the Lord says, do you well to be angry? Well, Jonah, you've had the most successful evangelistic campaign in history. How many? Over 100,000? 120,000, wasn't it? From the king to the lowliest subject, repented in sackcloth and ashes, turned from their evil ways. And so the Lord repented of what he was going to do to them. And Jonah was more concerned about his professional reputation as a prophet than he was about the salvation of 120,000 people who didn't deserve salvation. Jonah was afraid of going back to Jerusalem and walking down the streets of Jerusalem, and the little children at their play would look up and see him, and they'd jump up and down and say, Jonah's a false prophet. Jonah's a false prophet. Ellen White says that in Prophets and Kings. The most successful evangelistic campaign in the history of evangelism, a 40-day campaign and 120,000 converts. But he cared more about his professional reputation as a prophet than he did out of winning all of those souls. Now, I have to tell you, about 150 years later, to borrow a phrase from Paul, the Ninevites repented of their repentance. And then God did to them what he, through Jonah, threatened to do to them. And he wiped them off the face of the earth so completely that for the next 2,500 years, archaeologists couldn't even find the site of old Nineveh, and most of them doubted among themselves whether there really had been a place called Nineveh. They thought maybe it was just a mythological creation of somebody's mind. Well, in the 1830s and 40s, I think it was, some of the archaeologists finally did establish the site of old Nineveh. But my friends, Jonah was not made a true prophet 150 years after he made his prediction and after he undoubtedly had passed to his rest. Now, With regard to the second coming, I want to start out here by making a couple of points. First of all, I want us to understand that the fact of the second coming, is not conditional. The fact of the second coming is not conditional. As Nahum 1:9 so stirringly demonstrates, where the prophet cries out hundreds of years before Christ came the first time, "What do you imagine against the Lord? He will make an utter end. Affliction shall not rise up the second time." Friends, the second coming, the fact of the second coming is not up for grabs. But the time of the second coming is conditional, which incidentally helps to explain a seeming contradiction between the writings of Peter and the writings of Paul in the New Testament. Now, you're all familiar with 2 Peter 3:12. We've quoted it often. We encourage ourselves with it. Peter wrote to the Christians of his day, telling them not only to look for the second coming, but also to hasten it along by finishing the work that Christ gave them to do. And interestingly, Ellen White reflects this urgency of Peter, this invitation to hurry it along, to hasten it along. 2 years before she died, she wrote this in the Review and Herald, "By giving the gospel to the world, it is in our power to hasten the coming of the day of God." So if you can hasten, of course, presumably you can hinder. Presumably nothing is in concrete here. So let's hasten the second coming. But Paul over there on Mars Hill in Athens, talking to the literati, the intelligentsia of that city, on his way up there, in fact, Ellen White gives us an eyewitness account in her Acts of the Apostles. Paul was down there on the floor of the Agora, the marketplace, and you can go to Athens today and walk on the same stones that Paul walked on. He found an altar to the unknown God, and he figured that was as good a place as to start his evangelistic campaign as any. And so he stands there and he starts talking, and pretty soon a little knot of people comes around, and a larger group, and a larger group, and a larger group. And he says, "You've got an altar here to the unknown God. Well, I know who he is, and I want to tell you about it." Well, the crowd was noisy, and it was hard to hear. And so they said, "Paul, look, let's go on up to Mars Hill. Let's go up there. That's where the intellectuals come. That's where the philosophers come to explain and expound. Let's go up there. It'll be a lot quieter than here." And so Paul says, "All right." So they take the path that you can take today, and I took it on, I think, more than one occasion. Shaded by, I think, eucalyptus trees, as I remember, and you make your way up to that rocky outcropping that is called the Mars Hill. It faces the Acropolis and the Parthenon and some of that beautiful statuary, which is really suffering from atmospheric pollution, and it is really in pretty bad state today. And as they were going up, somebody sidled up to Paul and said, "Fella, I don't know who you are. You better be careful when you get up there on Mars Hill. These Athenians make a big brag about how they like democracy." And you know, folks, even today, the Athenians will tell you Mars Hill was the birthplace of democracy. Theoretically, you could say anything you want to and get away with it. But this man warned Paul, and he said, "Paul, remember, you seem to be a setter forth of strange gods. You better be careful when you get up there. Remember what they did to Socrates. He had to drink the poison cup of hemlock. You may suffer the same fate. You better be careful, Paul." And Paul thanks this unknown well-wisher and plods on up the hill. And he gets there and he starts a tremendous presentation, but he never got through the introduction to it. He talked about the God that we serve, in whom we live and move and have our being. He talked about the great problems in Greek philosophy about God. A great issue in that day, was God transcendent? Was he way out there? Or was God immanent? Was he inside? And he cut this Gordian knot and said he's both. He is out there, but he is also inside. He talked about a lot of things. He talked about how God made of one blood all men for to walk upon the face of the earth, a message that still needs to be preached from pulpits today. And then he got to talking about Jesus. Paul couldn't talk very long without coming around to Jesus, his favorite subject. And Paul talked about the man that God hath appointed. God has appointed a man and appointed a day in which he will judge the world by that man, Christ Jesus, whom he raised from the dead. And his introduction came to an end. Talk about the unfinished symphony. Paul never even got into the body of his sermon. They didn't even let him finish the introduction. When he talked about resurrection, they cut off his water, because every Greek knew from Greek philosophy, from Plato on down, that the soul is immortal. There is no resurrection, and you can't have. They are mutually antithetical, mutually exclusive. You cannot have resurrection of the body and immortality of the soul, something that the clergy of today still haven't quite cottoned on to. And when Paul talked about resurrection, they said, thanks, come again sometime when we have a more convenient season. We'll hear the rest of your presentation. And crestfallen, Paul left, for he had not the opportunity that he had sought to witness for his Lord. But before he finished, he made that statement, God has appointed a day. But wait, what was it Peter said? We can hasten the coming? Are Peter and Paul speaking at cross purposes here? Are they contradictory, mutually exclusive? No. The statements form a paradox, not a discrepancy. Both statements are true when correctly understood in their total context. You see, God has appointed a day. I call it a backstop date. Yes, Peter was right. We can hasten the coming if we do our work a little better than we have been doing it before. We can hasten the coming. But nevertheless, God has appointed a date, a backstop date, beyond which this thing is not going to go on ad infinitum. We can hasten the coming, but in the ultimate sense, my friends, we cannot hinder judgment day. God has appointed a day. And interestingly, both of these motifs are found in Ellen White's writings. Leroy Edwin Froom has helpfully pointed out in that massive work of scholarly research, which is called Movement of Destiny. Froom, in two chapters, cites 45 statements of Ellen White, each one placed in chronological sequence. The first is 1850, and the last is 1911, just 4 years before she passed. And you can sum up those 45 statements in one sentence. If we'd done our work, the Lord would have come before now. But then in the next chapter, Froom also cites another 13 statements, these made between 1863 and 1915, a period of just more than a half century, in which Mrs. White indicates that there is a backstop date, or in Froom's words, a predetermined boundary line irrevocably fixed beyond which God will not wait. Many of those statements in the latter category are couched in the metaphor of a cup of iniquity. When it is full, it will trigger the second coming and the judgments of God against the wicked. So while the fact of the second coming is itself not up for grabs, is not conditional, not subject to the conditional element of prophecy, the time of the second coming is conditional. And furthermore, Ellen White appears, even in her day, to hint to the church that maybe we won't succeed in hastening it, and that our time will run out and we will wind up at that backstop date which God has provided. There were two statements that she made in the year 1885, just a few weeks apart, 2.5 months apart, actually. The first was in a Review and Herald article of December 15, 1885. It's found in Selected Messages, Book 1, page 118. It's a familiar statement. You've heard it often. When divine power is combined with human effort, the work will spread like fire in the stubble. Many of Ellen White's metaphors were couched in the agrarian age in which she lived, the world of agriculture. When divine power is combined with human effort, the work will spread like fire in the stubble. God will employ agencies whose origin man will be unable to discern. And then she gives you one example of these unseen agencies whose origin we cannot determine. She says, angels will do a work which men might have had the blessing of accomplishing had they not neglected to answer the claims of God. Maybe angels will have to come in and finish it because God has appointed a day in which he will judge the world by that man, Christ Jesus. A couple of months earlier, and this is found today in Testimonies to Ministers, page 300, Ellen White writing to a conference president, talking about when the loud cry of the third angel shall be heard, when light goes forth to lighten the earth. She says, "Let me tell you that the Lord will work in this last work in a manner very much out of the common order of things and in a way that will be contrary to any human planning." In the few lines down, God will use ways and means by which it will be seen that he is taking the reins in his own hands. The workers will be surprised by the simple means that he will use to bring about and perfect his work of righteousness. 1885, God will take the reins in his hands. Every reader of the Review and Herald immediately understood the metaphor, horse and buggy days. And you traveled around in a horse-drawn conveyance and you guided the horse by means of reins. When I was a little boy, about 10 years of age, my daddy was an evangelist and we didn't see a great deal of him around home because he was so busy doing the Lord's work. But on Sunday mornings, daddy would take me in our 1936 Dodge outside of town into the countryside. And he would let me come over and sit very close to him, close enough that I could reach up with my hands to the steering wheel, and he would let me drive the car. My legs were not long enough to reach the accelerator, the brake, or the clutch, and that didn't bother me at all. Daddy can do that. For me, the important thing was steering. And so, Sunday morning, there isn't all that much traffic on those rural roads outside of Columbus, Ohio, Toledo, Lakewood. And so we would go out and I could drive the car. Now, if I had looked down, which I didn't, I was very careful to look ahead and watch, you know, to see everything so I didn't run into something. Had I looked down, daddy's hands were down at the bottom of the steering wheel, but I didn't notice it at the time. And this was, to my little heart, one of the biggest thrills that you could imagine. And after an hour or so, daddy had to get back home because he had to start putting the finishing touches on his Sunday night evangelistic sermon. And so as we started kind of getting home, getting close to the city limits and traffic beginning to pick up just a little bit, daddy said to me, he said, "Roger, slip over on the other side of the seat now. I'm going to take over and take us home." And I like to think, my brother, my sister, that someday sooner than you or I can possibly imagine tonight, God in his graciousness is going to say to you and to me, "Slip over on the seat now. I'm taking the reins in my own hand." What was it that Paul said in Romans 9? "For he will finish the work and cut it short in righteousness, for a short work will the Lord make in all the earth." My dear friends, the ultimate urgency of the second coming of our Lord has nothing to do with the signs which were foretold to precede it. Nothing to do with prophetic charts of last day events. Those things have their place. The ultimate urgency of the second coming, however, has nothing to do even with the haste with which we attempt to finish the work of God in all the world. The real ultimate urgency of the second coming, I think, is found in Paul's letter to the Christians at Philippi. In Philippians chapter 1, verses 23 and 24, a very provocative and I think a very instructive text. Paul talking here, "For I am in a strait betwixt two, having a desire to depart," what he's talking about is die, "having a desire to depart and to be with Christ, which from my perspective is far better. Nevertheless, to abide in the flesh is more needful to you." Now, Paul did not believe, And friend, Paul did not teach, as many Christians today take for granted that he both believed and taught, that the righteous dead go to heaven immediately at death. Paul understood very clearly, it is clear from an examination of his various writings, that the righteous dead rather wait in the grave in a state that Jesus himself likened unto sleep until the loud trumpet of the angel announces the second coming. But Paul also recognized that this sleep is a dreamless state, and as far as the dead are concerned, it is but a split second in consciousness between shutting one's eyes in sleep and opening them at the sound of the trump at the second coming, hopefully at the second coming of Christ. Did you hear Earl Cleveland's sermon one time about the man who slept through the second coming and came up at the third coming at the end of the millennium? Friend, the real urgency, the ultimate urgency of the second coming for people in Bible times and for people in our time, which incidentally explains the urgency and the imminence stressed both in the Bible and in the writings of Ellen White, the ultimate urgency of the second coming is in this fact that not one of us in this building tonight knows how many more breaths we will take before we close our eyes in that dreamless slumber. And that is why Ellen White would write in the fifth volume of the Testimonies, page 200 in 1882, "We are today to watch that we offend not in word or deed. We must today seek God and be determined that we will not rest satisfied without His presence." Now listen to this. "We should watch and work and pray as though this were our last day that would be granted to us, because we will never know when that last day will come." Tomorrow morning, with regret, I will take my leave from you and go down to the Asheville airport. I will get on successively three airplanes, Asheville to Charlotte, Charlotte to Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh to Hagerstown, Maryland. And I will arrive at the Hagerstown airport, if everybody is on time and all goes well, about 3:30 in the afternoon, at which time my wife will be there to meet me and greet me and to take me the rest of the way home, 47 more miles. I have faith to believe that those airplanes are going to take off at the appropriate time, that those airplanes are going to fly uneventfully, and that those airplanes are going to come down in the right place at the right time, each one of them. But I recognize, as I do every time I travel for the Lord, that sometimes airplanes don't come down in the right place, at the right time, in the right way. I'm flying U.S. Airways tomorrow, and there's a spot just outside Pittsburgh, my second destination before I finally wind up in Hagerstown. There's a place just outside Pittsburgh in which the employees, flight crews of U.S. Airways kind of avert their gaze when they go over, because a few years ago one of their big planes went down with a horrendous loss of life, and they don't want to think about that. And I'll be honest with you, I am not a morbid type of person. I don't particularly want to think about that either. I have never been afraid in an airplane. I have seen people who were. I've never been afraid. I read in the book of Acts that Paul was on a ship with several hundred other people that was floundering, which was about ready to go down, and an angel came to him and said, "Paul, God still has work for you to do up there in Rome. You've got to bear your testimony to the emperor and the government of Rome. And because you've got to get there, God has given you all of the rest of your fellow passengers." You know, I would think that the airlines would give Seventh-day Adventist ministers free tickets. I mean, talk about insurance. If God's got work for you to do, you're going to get there. And friends, if God doesn't have any more work for Roger Kuhn to do, if this sermon tonight is Roger Kuhn's last sermon, so be it. It doesn't really matter where I sleep until I hear that wonderful voice beckoning me to come forth. The ultimate urgency of the second coming is that we none of us know how many more breaths we may take before we drift into that dreamless slumber to await the call of the life giver. You hear about Luther Warren? Born in Michigan, 1864. Entered the ministry at the age of 24. Tent master in an evangelistic campaign right there 10 miles from Andrews University in Benton Harbor. In education, he had not hardly gotten past high school, but he was such an able, eloquent, gifted speaker of talent that they sent him out anyway without further education. And of course, at the turn of the century, that wasn't as big a thing as it is today. And he went on to hold large, successful evangelistic campaigns in such cities as New York, Chicago, Washington, D.C., Omaha, Lincoln, Los Angeles, Portland, Seattle, Vancouver. He was a boy wonder. In early January of 1907, he was invited to come to Kingston, the capital of Jamaica, to conduct an evangelistic campaign at the time of the local union conference's annual planning session. And they decided, we will have a field school of evangelism here with this tremendously successful evangelist from up there in North America, and he'll come down to the islands and he'll show our island ministers how to do it successfully. So they shipped a large tent from the United States, but there was insufficient time to put it up. It was slow in arriving at Kingston Harbor. And so they booked the Kingston Town Hall, which was located second story over the local post office in a major downtown location. Luther Warren was now 42 years of age. He'd been a minister for the past 18 years. The opening topic of his campaign was like many of our opening meetings in evangelism, Daniel 2, the history of the world prefigured from Babylonia of Daniel's time to the second coming of Christ, represented by the stone that smites the image of this man, breaking the image to pieces and grinding it all up to powder. And on that opening night, to a capacity audience, incredibly, Luther Warren told his audience all about this prophecy in the first 3 or 4 minutes of his discourse. Well, having exhausted his subject so quickly, there was nothing to do but go on to the topic scheduled for Monday night. And he dispatched that in about 10 or 12 minutes. And there still was time to go. And so he went on to the third and the fourth and the fifth topic. In fact, he went through all the prophecies. Second coming, final judgment, standards of the judgment, the law of God, Sabbath, the importance of obedience. And when he finished, he had given literally a synopsis of the whole Bible, entire Bible truth, in the same length of time that his original sermon on one chapter in Daniel 2 should have taken. In the meantime, behind the scenes, Elder George F. Enoch, the ministerial director of the union, was absolutely beside himself in anguish. Back behind the curtain, he was pacing back and forth, thinking that his campaign had been ruined on its opening night, worrying about this bad example that was being set, incredibly being set by one of the most successful evangelists in North America, bad example to the local ministers. This was not the way to do evangelism. And then, as he stopped a moment to cup his ear to hear where Warren was in his presentation, he is incredulous to discover that, incredibly, Warren is now making an altar call in his closing appeal, asking for those who would obey God in all things to come forward for baptism and church membership. And George F. Enoch was just about ready to go through the roof. He listened again. What's the man saying? He peeked through the curtain, and he saw tears streaming down the face of this young evangelist. And with great emotion, Elder Warren told his audience, I am impressed to tell you that with many of you tonight, this is heaven's last call. Come and come tonight. Come now. And they came. The response was tremendous. Luther Warren did not know it, but his campaign's opening night turned out to be his campaign's closing night. Because at 3:32 p.m. the next afternoon, Monday afternoon, on January 14, 1907, the capital city of Kingston in Jamaica lay in ruins. For the city was either at or very near the epicenter of a major earthquake, practically on ground zero. And that earthquake shook that island city for exactly 20 seconds. And in 20 seconds, This powerful earthquake brought down or severely damaged every single major building in town. Thousands of people were buried under the rubble of brick and masonry, impaled on shards of shattered glass and spears of splintered wood, buried under rubble. And many who had heard the whole message in a single evangelistic sermon the opening Sunday night never came back to a second night. Indeed, there never was a second night, and these people died in a tragic, horrible Holocaust. And no one ever again reproached the evangelist to ask him or his God why he had preached such an unorthodox sermon and made a call for baptism to an audience he would never again meet. How soon is soon? How near is near? It could be just a moment away. Oh, I promised to tell you, didn't I? The secret of finally making it. Let this be a little postscript to the message. Can you be sure that you can make it? Yes. And let me give you the secret of success at the risk of oversimplification. Steps to Christ, page 70. Consecrate yourself to God in the morning. Make this your very first work. Let your prayer be, take me, O Lord, as holy thine. I lay all my plans at thy feet. Use me today in thy service. Abide with me and let all my work be wrought in thee. She goes on. This is a daily matter. Make this your very first work every morning of your life, because remember, every day may be the last day. We don't know at its onset. This is a daily matter. Each morning, consecrate yourself to God for that day. Surrender all of your plans to Him to be carried out or given up as His providence shall indicate. Thus, day by day, you may be giving your life into the hands of God, and thus your life will be molded more and more after the life of Christ. And a little farther in that same book, 94, Steps to Christ. The darkness of the evil one encloses those who neglect to pray. The whispered temptations of the enemy entice them to sin, and it is all because they do not make use of the privileges that God has given them in the divine appointment of prayer. Why should the sons and daughters of God be reluctant to pray when prayer is the key in the hand of faith to unlock heaven's storehouse where are treasured the boundless resources of omnipotence? Listen, friend, without unceasing prayer, without diligent watching, we are in danger of growing careless and of deviating from the right path. The adversary seeks continually to obstruct the way to the mercy seat that we may not, by earnest supplication and faith, obtain grace and power to resist temptation. And let me read you the last one in Desire of Ages, to 323 and 324. The soul that is yielded to Christ becomes his own fortress, which he holds in a revolted world. And he intends that no authority shall be known in it but his own. A soul thus kept in possession by the heavenly agencies is impregnable to the assaults of Satan. But unless we do yield ourselves to the control of Christ, we shall be dominated by the wicked one. We must inevitably be under the control of the one or the other of the two great powers that are contending for the supremacy of the world. Now listen to this. It is not necessary for us deliberately to choose the service of the kingdom of darkness in order to come under its dominion. We have only to neglect to ally ourselves with the kingdom of light. If we do not cooperate with the heavenly agencies, Satan will take possession of the heart and make it his abiding place. The only defense against evil is the indwelling of Christ in the heart through faith in his righteousness. Unless we become vitally connected with God, we can never resist the unhallowed effects of self-love, self-indulgence, temptation to sin. We may leave off many bad habits for the time. We may part company with Satan, But without a vital connection with God, through the surrender of ourselves to Him moment by moment, we shall be overcome. Without a personal acquaintance with Christ and a continual communion, we are at the mercy of the enemy and we shall do his bidding in the end. And with that, we have come full circle to the closing illustrations of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. When someone comes, let me in. Lord, I've worked miracles in your name. Lord, I've prophesied in your name. Lord, I've done many wonderful things in your name. And incredibly, the voice comes through the closed gate saying, "Depart from me. I never knew you." My brother and sister, I appeal to you to be faithful to Jesus. Some Carolina camp meeting will be the last Carolina camp meeting and will never know at that time that it is it. This could be, I don't want to cry wolf, wolf, and keep frightening you, keep threatening you. But this, conceivably, could be the last Carolina camp meeting. This could be my last sermon, depending on how the airplanes behave tomorrow. I'm not afraid. I'm not worried. The ultimate urgency of the second coming is that we do not know how many more breaths we shall draw before our eyes are closed in slumber. My appeal to you tonight is total commitment and the following of that secret, little secret. Commit yourself to God in the morning. Let this be your very first work. And if you do that, the rest of the day will be a walk with you and Jesus. And with Jesus by your side, you cannot fail. May God make that a living reality in the experience of each one of us for His name's sake. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries have been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry, as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.